Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. Our lead story, once again, is, well, bad news. We're well into the third wave of the coronavirus pandemic. And many countries in Europe, England, Germany, France, are either in lockdown or considering lockdown, which will, of course, accelerate the number of bankruptcies and the hardship as the economy collapses in many of these countries. Flu season is around the corner. The holiday season's around the corner. And that means, of course, more family get-togethers and more potential transmission of the virus. But also, good news. First of all, good news on the vaccine front. Not one, not two, but three vaccines are being readied for mass distribution already in China and Russia. They've already begun distributing of their vaccines. So we'll talk about the pros and cons of the various vaccines that are being looked at. And then the question is, well, is it safe to travel during the holiday season? Well, maybe not. There's a flight that went from Dubai to New Zealand, an 18-hour flight. One person on that flight who tested negative, by the way, was actually positive, and he went on to infect at least seven other passengers on that very same flight, even though the airlines took many safety precautions. It just goes to show you that when you talk to somebody, please don't talk more than about 15 minutes. And then a mystery is being cleared up. Why is it that children suffer less than elderly when it comes to catching the coronavirus? And for that matter, why is it that some adults, up to 50%, are asymptomatic and have no signs of the virus at all? Well, we're beginning to complete the dots now, and so I'll tell you about what's the latest concerning what we know and don't know about the coronavirus. And then we'll go into outer space in today's exploration. SpaceX is once again making the news. This time, for the second time, it made history, able to launch because of a public-private collaboration between NASA and SpaceX, a new set of astronauts to the International Space Station. So are we entering a new era in space exploration? Not to mention the fact that we've also had a huge setback. The Arecibo radio telescope will be dismantled. And there's hardly a dry eye among the astronomical community. The Arecibo radio telescope has been the workhorse of the SETI program, the workhorse of analyzing objects deep in the galaxy and in other galaxies. And not one, but two cables recently snapped. And because of safety considerations, the Arecibo radio telescope will be mothballed. This is a tremendous setback in science, but hey, these setbacks do happen once in a while. Well, let's just jump right into the top science stories of the past week. The lead story, once again, is bad news, especially in Europe and the United States. We're talking about several countries, including France, Germany, Belgium, England, either undergoing lockdown or considering lockdown. And people are, quite frankly, suffering from lockdown fatigue. And as a consequence, people are getting lax. They're not wearing their masks. They're not obeying social distancing. And we're seeing a third spike. That's right, the third wave of the coronavirus at precisely the wrong time. We're entering the holiday season. We're entering the flu season. People are going to get together with their loved ones. You know, all of us now exist in a bubble. That bubble consists of maybe you, your wife, husband, and your children. And as long as you stay within that bubble, chances are you're going to be relatively okay. But during the holiday season, you're going to bump into other bubbles. And that's the problem. Even though you may trust the people in your bubble, do you necessarily trust the people in other bubbles? And just remember that the economy is teetering on collapse in some of these countries. Many companies, for example, only exist because of Christmas. That's right. During the year, they actually register negative sales, but they compensate that by having large Christmas sales. Well, all that could be turned upside down, and we could be witnessing a wave of bankruptcies as a consequence of the fact that the holiday season may be terminated. Sorry about that. However, there's also good news on the therapeutic and vaccine front. First of all, not one, not two, but three, maybe more now, vaccines are being ready for distribution to the public. For example, we have the vaccines from Pfizer, from Moderna, from Oxford, that are undergoing phase three trials, that is up to 30,000 individuals being tested. And the first indications are spectacular, over 90% effective. So you get a group of people that are vaccinated, a second group of people that just get a placebo, and then you just wait. You wait and see what percent get infected. And it turns out that 90% of the infections are in the placebo group, not in the vaccinated group. However, let's be honest. First of all, these things have to be tested for side effects. And so far, we've only had about 1 or 2 months worth of experience, mainly with the Chinese and the Russians. And many people shake their heads when it comes to analyzing the efficacy of the Russian vaccine, given the fact that about 4 doctors who were vaccinated with the Russian vaccine eventually came down with the virus. Now, one big drawback with the vaccines is the fact that they have to be kept refrigerated to below zero. In fact, many pharmacies are stocking up with dry ice in order to make sure that the vaccine remains refrigerated, or else the vaccine will disintegrate when temperatures begin to rise. That's the first big drawback. Not everyone is equipped to handle a vaccine at these very low temperatures. And second of all, we really don't know how long the vaccine is going to last. For example, the coronavirus is actually a member of a family of coronaviruses, and some of the vaccines for them only last a few months. So we're crossing our fingers and hoping that it'll last longer than that, but we simply don't know how long the protection from the vaccine will last. Sorry about that. And then you may have to be vaccinated more than once, at least twice, perhaps about a month apart. Now, we should also point out there's another company coming out with a different kind of vaccine, that is Johnson & Johnson. Now, Johnson & Johnson, instead of playing around with very fancy RNA state-of-the-art vaccination, stayed with a tried-and-true method. You know, think back to the polio vaccine. You take a weakened or dead virus. The incubation process takes place in eggs. It's a slower process, but it's surefire, and it works. So that's the Johnson & Johnson approach. The advantage is perhaps you only need one shot, not two. And second of all, no refrigeration. That is a tremendous advantage because then you don't have to mess around with dry ice and other things. And we also should point out that in the post-pandemic world, even if you've been vaccinated, it doesn't mean that you are home free. Because if it's only 90% effective, that means 10% of the time, oops, you could come down with the coronavirus. Not to mention the fact that herd immunity, we really don't know what percent of the population has to undergo the vaccine to attain herd immunity. So it's still a work in progress, though of course it's a tremendous, tremendous victory for science that in such a short period of time, they were able to come up not with one, not with two, but perhaps 50 different vaccines around the world. However, during the holiday season, there's a word of caution, and that is you're tempted to get on the airplane and visit mom or dad or whoever, but there's a problem there. Recently, in New Zealand, they analyzed passengers coming in from Dubai. It is an 18-hour flight from Dubai to New Zealand, and there are precautions. You got to get tested. In fact, one passenger tested negative. He was asymptomatic, got on the airplane. For 18 hours, and he flew to New Zealand, where you're quarantined then for 2 weeks. During that quarantine, he came down with the virus. Oops. In other words, when he tested negative, it takes time. It takes time for the virus to infect the body. And during the trip, he got infected. And so, after an 18-hour flight, even with precautions taken by the airlines, about 7 other individuals came down with the virus. How do we know that it came down from that person? Because these people were quarantined. They could be analyzed. The virus could be analyzed, and sure enough, it was the same virus that infected everybody that came down. Now, what's the lesson here? Well, the lesson here is that the virus can spread simply by talking to someone. So if you have to talk to somebody, talk no more than about 15 minutes, they say. And also try not to be indoors, because if you're indoors, the air does not circulate very well. And if somebody sneezed hours ago, you may be infected. And so in other words, during this 18-hour flight, even with the airlines taking precautions, even with these people testing negative, it still spread. And it's not hearsay. We know that because the doctors in New Zealand quarantined these people for 14 days. And so a word to the wise, if you have to travel, then think twice and think about the precautions you can take if you get on an airplane. And like I said, if you have to talk to people, don't talk for more than about 15 minutes. Also, a little piece of good news. Doctors are now zeroing in on a mystery. Why is it that some people are pretty much immune to the virus? In fact, about 50% of the people are totally asymptomatic. And why is it that children, relatively speaking, are less susceptible to the virus than the elderly? Well, we're beginning to now put the pieces together. It turns out that it's possible to create a metric now so that when you're in the hospital, people can predict. Doctors can now predict if you're going to be asymptomatic or come down with very severe consequences of the virus. What scientists are saying is autoantibodies could be the key. You know, lupus, certain forms of arthritis, it's the body attacking itself. The body goes haywire. The body creates antibodies that, instead of protecting you, actually backfire and injure you as a consequence. Well, that could be measured. You can actually measure the amount of autoantibodies and therefore correlate it with the severity of the symptoms from the coronavirus. And sure enough, it does appear as if people that are most susceptible to the virus with the largest set of side effects are the ones who also have the highest level of autoantibodies. And speaking of antibodies, children have a lot more colds than adults. And it's believed that because of that, some of the cold viruses that children have been infected with are relatives of COVID-19. See, COVID-19 is a member of a family of coronaviruses. Some of them are cold viruses. And we think that's probably the reason why children are relatively more immune than adults, especially the elderly. Now, this also means that adults also got these coronaviruses when they were children, but the immunity didn't last. And so that's a theory that has now been not verified, but evidence has been given using concrete studies of individuals testing their autoantibodies levels in their blood. So if true, it means that even in the hospital, doctors can know ahead of time what your reaction might be to the virus. Also, here's another bit of good news, and that is the U.S. government has now approved yet another monoclonal antibody as a therapeutic. So let me explain. Just several months ago, medical science was powerless, totally powerless in the face of the virus. The virus was new. We didn't understand it. We didn't have any therapeutics. We didn't have any antibodies for it. But since then, there have been a number of breakthroughs. First of all, dexamethasone is a steroid, very cheap, about $1 a day, and it's saving lives because of the fact that we now know that the virus itself does not really kill you. That's right. The virus itself does not kill you. The virus creates what is called a cytokine storm. That is, the body overreacts. The body overreacts, floods itself with antibodies that then begin to injure organs. So dexamethasone is a steroid. It's taken in the later stages of the virus, and it means that lives are being saved. Hospitalization rates, death rates are actually going down as a consequence of dexamethasone. And then we have convalescent antibodies. It turns out that people that have been exposed to the virus, their blood is chock full of antibodies that can be purified and injected into another patient. Well, we have biotechnology. So why don't we simply clone the antibodies to create unlimited quantities? You see, if you've been exposed to the virus and recovered, and you're altruistic, you want to help your fellow human being by donating your plasma, you can only donate so much plasma over a certain period of time because, after all, it is your blood. There's only so much you can donate safely over a certain period of time. So that's where this synthetic antibody comes in. And now the U.S. government has given a seal of approval. In fact, this particular monoclonal antibody was the same one given to President Donald Trump. And so this is one way to boost the power of your immune system by administering antibodies that will then fight the infection. And so in other words, our arsenal, we have more and more medicines entering our arsenal as we know more and more about the disease. And now I'd like to leave the planet Earth and blast off into outer space. Yes, SpaceX, the company founded by Elon Musk, is once again making headlines. It turns out that, well, we know that President Barack Obama canceled the space shuttle program, canceled the replacement for the space shuttle program called the Constellation, and said that we have to rely on the Russians for access to the International Space Station, and he set into motion a partnership, a public-private partnership, to help to reduce the cost of space travel so that the U.S. government would become like a secondary player when it deals with sending astronauts into space. Well, SpaceX made headlines when, for the first time in modern times, we sent American astronauts into outer space using private funds. Of course, they were helped subsidized by the federal government. And now, for the second time, a successful launch was made to the International Space Station. Many people are saying that we're now entering the second era of space exploration. The first era of space exploration was, well, we had a dream. Beat the Russians. In fact, the space shuttle program was sort of distorted because of that fact, that it was born out of a rivalry between the great powers. Now we're entering the second era of space exploration, where a public-private partnership is helping to reduce costs. You realize that each shuttle mission of old cost about $1 billion, $1 billion per space shuttle launch. SpaceX says that they could bring it down to a fraction of that. In fact, to put anything in orbit, to put a satellite into orbit around the planet Earth, costs about $10,000 a pound. That's about your weight in gold. Think about that. Your weight in gold, that's what it costs to put you in orbit just around the planet Earth. SpaceX says that they can bring it down by a factor of 2 to 10. In other words, a tremendous savings by going public. Well, NASA, of course, is hedging its bets. It's also putting money on the SLS booster rocket, not using the cost-cutting methods of Elon Musk, but relying on Boeing and other very traditional makers of spacecraft. However, the SLS booster rocket, which is favored by NASA, is way over its allotted time and money, and it may cost about $1 billion per launch, harkening back to the early days of the space shuttle program. So who's going to win out? SLX, which many people think is a bloated government-sponsored rocket, or the streamlined Falcon Heavy put forth by Elon Musk and private enterprise? Well, we'll have to see what happens. But the point I'm raising is prices are going to be dropping. Space tourism could become a reality. And it means that outer space may become a place where humans, not just astronauts, but ordinary people may one day venture. And speaking about outer space, we had a disaster recently with the Arecibo radio telescope. You know, if you saw the movie with James Bond or the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, the background was the Arecibo radio telescope. I had a chance to visit that telescope years ago, and it was a marvelous piece of machinery. It's a workhorse that allowed us to probe distant stars, distant galaxies, sometimes in search for perhaps intelligent signals from alien civilizations, in fact. Well, this month we had a disaster. First, a cable snapped. And before we could begin the process of repairing that cable, a second cable snapped, which revealed that the superstructure of the radio telescope was much more degraded and weakened than we previously thought. Then it turned out that estimates of what it would take to repair it would put the workers in jeopardy. In other words, it simply wasn't worth it anymore to try to repair the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico. So it's going to be dismantled. That's a crying shame. It's been one of the workhorses of radio telescope astronomy, much better than optical telescopes. Optical telescopes only see in the optical range, and they cannot penetrate dust clouds very well. Radio telescopes, they can peer right through many dust clouds, giving us an unprecedented look at the universe that it actually is, rather than the universe that you can see through an optical telescope. Then the next question is, will a replacement be made? That's not exactly sure right now. However, scientists around the world are mourning the passing of the Arecibo radio telescope, the workhorse of radio telescope astronomy, the workhorse of the SETI program. And talking about outer space, let me summarize some of the news that's taking place in outer space. First of all, if you're from Australia, specifically Tasmania, you had a tremendous sight of a fireball that lit up the night sky. That's right, about 60 miles off the coast of Tasmania, instruments recorded a fireball coming in from outer space. And the fireball, of course, did not do much damage, fortunately, but it lit up the night sky. And there's a video that you can download on the web. It's a fantastic video of a fireball coming in from outer space, probably an asteroid. That is a piece of rock that usually orbits between Mars and Jupiter, but sometimes intersects with the orbit of the planet Earth. Now, we don't know where it landed, probably in the oceans, but it probably did not do much damage, but it certainly gave us a spectacular light show. And here's another tidbit from outer space. 2 years ago, Elon Musk launched a spaceship that would take humans to the planet Mars. Many people shook their heads thinking that, oh, this is a publicity stunt. But hey, what's wrong with the publicity stunt? Well, in the rocket ship was Starman. Starman was a dummy that looked like an astronaut. And he was in the pilot seat. And the pilot seat was a Tesla sports car. So in other words, Elon Musk wanted to show off, and he basically was hurling a car at Mars. Well, 2 years later, the probe is still flying its way around the solar system, and it's coming close to the planet Mars now. So in other words, who would have thought that a private individual would be able to launch a rocket that could go all the way to the planet Mars, even if there's a sports car inside that rocket ship? Also, here's another piece of news concerning the atmosphere of the Earth. You know, carbon dioxide is building up in the atmosphere because of the fact that we burn fossil fuels, and that in turn is changing the weather because light from the sun checks in, but it doesn't check out because it goes through carbon dioxide and changes frequency once it bounces off the surface of the Earth. So, some people say, why not instigate carbon capture? And different forms of carbon capture exist. One of them is to plant trees. That's right. A new study that just came out did the calculation. That is, how much land area would it take? How many trees would it take to gobble up some of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? And then, of course, there's some minerals that also eat up carbon dioxide. And so in this report that just came out, they looked at all possible chemical reactions, biological reactions that would allow us to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Now, this report was the first to definitively look at the numbers. What would it take? What would it cost in order to begin a process of reforestation, a process of remineralization, changing the chemistry of the Earth itself? Well, the results are very encouraging. They showed that it was, in fact, possible to do it. However, let's be real. The cost would be enormous because a lot of this land is already owned by somebody else or by governments that may not be inclined to donate forested land in order to reforest whole areas of the planet Earth. But the point is, it is possible. It's just a question of political and economic will. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. This is Dr. Michio Kaku. And in the second part, we're going to go into perhaps one of the most active areas of research today, quantum computers. Computer power is beginning to level off. The nations of the world realize that a supercomputer, a quantum computer, can break any code by any nation. And there's a mad scramble now on the part of the nations of the world and also industry to perfect a computer that computes on atoms. So, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Professor Seth Lloyd, professor at MIT, talking about the ultimate computer, the quantum computer, a computer that, quote, computes on individual atoms, unquote. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and this is the second half of Exploration. Well, in the first part of Exploration, we talked about viruses, and we talked about the enormous devastation caused by the molecular level. But, you know, progress keeps on going. And a few months ago, if you've been following the headlines, you realize that Google made a rather astonishing announcement. They said that they've developed a new kind of computer, a quantum computer, that can compute faster than a supercomputer of today. That sent shockwaves throughout the scientific community, because a quantum computer, many people believe, could be the ultimate computer. You know, the age of silicon is gradually coming to a close. We're etching millions of transistors on a tiny wafer of silicon, so many that the distance between these transistors is measured in atoms. Right now, your Pentium chip has layers maybe 20 atoms across. And in the coming years, we'll eventually hit maybe 5 atoms across, in which case electrons hop over, the transistor short circuits, and the whole circuit fails. In other words, we could be witnessing the end of the age of silicon. And Silicon Valley knows this. Silicon Valley could become a rust belt in the coming years and decades. You realize that Moore's Law, which says that computer power doubles every 18 months, Moore's Law is slowing down. That's right. Now let me ask you a question. Would you buy a Christmas present with the next generation of computers, knowing that it is exactly the same in terms of speed as the previous, last year's generation of computers? Maybe not. Moore's Law is flattening out, because we're now down to atoms. So this is where our special guest today comes in. Dr. Seth Lloyd of MIT is one of the leaders in creating quantum computers, computers that compute on individual atoms. Now, an atom is like a spinning top. It has a north pole and a south pole, and in a magnetic field, they line up. And if you then shine a laser beam on these spinning tops, some of them flip over, making a calculation. So you can actually calculate on individual atoms. And some people think that this could be the ultimate computer. Well, the CIA is very much interested in this, because if you have a quantum computer, you can break any code of any nation on the planet Earth, including the United States. So the CIA is very much following these developments. Now, of course, it may take many years to decades before we perfect quantum computers, because, of course, we're computing on atoms now. The slightest disturbance can ruin the calculation. But there's a race going on between Russia, the United States, and Europe as to who can develop the first operational quantum computer, a computer that computes on atoms. And so once again with us today is Dr. Seth Lloyd, a professor at MIT, talking about quantum computers, and he even believes that the universe itself is a quantum computer. And I should also point out that some scientists have stated that maybe to create artificially intelligent brains, brains much more powerful than silicon computers, maybe we have to go to a quantum computer. So some people even think that once we have quantum computers, we'll be able to create robots as smart as us. Well, as you can imagine, there's a lot of interest in quantum computers. In fact, I spoke in Moscow about a year and a half ago at a conference, and sure enough, one of the main thrusts of that conference was, in fact, the Russian attempt to create a quantum computer. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor Seth Lloyd of MIT, author of a new controversial book called Programming the Universe. And the question is the universe a quantum computer? Now, let me explain.
We all know that computers that energize modern society are based on silicon. And the silicon chip that you have in your Pentium crams literally millions upon millions of tiny transistors into something that's a little bit bigger than your thumbnail. And the question is, how far can you go until the tiniest transistor becomes the size of an atom? Well, that time is coming. Perhaps in 20, 30 years, we don't know precisely when, but we do know that someday transistors will be so tiny that atoms of silicon simply won't do. We'll have to go to atomic computers, otherwise known as quantum computers, and Professor Lloyd is an expert in this area called quantum computation, and he thinks maybe even the universe is a quantum computer. Now, let me also note that atoms spin like a spinning top, and you all know that spinning tops have an arrow, the axis of spin, and that could point up or down. If it points up, that's a zero. If it points down, that's a one, and you get binary. But atoms are more than just binary. Atoms can also point sideways and anywhere in between, a superposition of up and down. And that's where we get into the bizarre world of the quantum theory, where you don't really know quite where this arrow is pointing, but you have much more freedom than simply zeros and ones. You have zeros and ones and in between. These are called qubits, or quantum bits. And Dr. Seth Lloyd is one of the world's experts in this new area. And of course, many people are interested in this. Modern technocrats are interested because one day quantum computers may have the internet on it, and as well as banking records and your credit card records, not to mention the fact that the CIA wants to get their handle on quantum computers because with it, you can crack any code with a quantum computer.
But you see, Dr. Lloyd goes even farther than that because you see, everything around us is governed by atoms. Atoms, in turn, obey quantum mechanics, and therefore he claims that the universe is one gigantic quantum computer. And if that's true, then what is it computing? What's the program? Who wrote the software? God? I mean, your mind starts to go crazy thinking about the possibility that maybe the universe is a quantum computer.
So once again, our special guest today is Dr. Seth Lloyd, author of the new book, Programming the Universe. Professor Lloyd, tell us a little bit about your youth. Were there any kinds of incidences or stories you'd like to tell about what set you off in a career in mathematics, computational physics, and physics?
Well, I always loved fooling around with numbers and with games and things involving geometry when I was a kid. I played a lot with blocks and would build huge geometric constructions as well as buildings with them. And then when I went to school, I was amazed to find out that there was a subject called physics where with relatively simple math, you could discover a huge amount about the way the world works. Of course, then I went to graduate school and found it was really the opposite. There's a huge amount of complicated math, and you only understand a little tiny bit about the way the world works. But by then, it was too late. I was suckered into the field.
And you also mentioned in your book that as a graduate student, everyone seemed to be doing string theory, but you saw your destiny going in a slightly different direction. Could you elaborate?
Sure. When I was at Cambridge University, I did a MPhil in history and philosophy of science and started working on ideas of information and quantum mechanics. I also studied quantum gravity with Stephen Hawking. And it struck me that there was a connection between these two ideas of quantum information and quantum gravity. So when I went to Rockefeller University to work with Heinz Pakels to do a PhD in physics, I started off working on ideas of quantum information and quantum gravity, basically the same thing that I'm doing today. Unfortunately, they didn't like that very much at Rockefeller University, and about halfway through, they told me I better cut it out and work on something more conventional like elementary particle physics or string theory.
Well, I guess reality intrudes. Heinz Pagels, I should also mention, was one of the early guests on Exploration, speaking about elementary particle physics. Now let's talk about things that are very practical. The average American, of course, says, what's in it for me? Numero uno. Am I going to get better internet reception? Am I going to get better computer power. So let's talk about computer power, computer games, and what we have for Christmas. Everybody knows that at Christmas time, your computer is almost twice as powerful as the computers of the previous Christmas, and that's called Moore's Law. So some people say, well, Moore's Law is going to go on forever. However, you think otherwise. So tell us a little bit about Moore's Law and why you think Moore's Law is going to break down so by Christmas time, we're not going to get Christmas presents that are almost twice as powerful as the previous Christmas.
Well, it's dangerous to predict that Moore's Law will break down. People have been predicting its imminent demise for decades, starting in the late 1960s. And every time some clever engineer managed to find a way around whatever specific problem seemed to be standing in the way of progress. And in fact, if you look at Moore's Law, it's not just one technology that has made computers get more powerful by a factor of two every year and a half or so. It's a whole series of technologies that have kicked in, from vacuum tubes to transistors to integrated circuits. And these technologies rely on the rapid improvement of other kinds of methods like machining, material science, et cetera. So Moore's Law is kind of the tip of the iceberg of this rapid improvement. However, it can't actually go on forever for a simple reason, that is that computers are governed by the laws of physics, and the laws of physics tell you how small you can make things and how fast you can do things. And so if you actually took all the energy in the universe and turned it into a gigantic computer, a possibility envisaged by Isaac Asimov in his story, The Last Question, I was able to calculate using the physics of information processing how big such a computer would be. And, this computer, this universal computer, if you like, up till now it could have performed about 10 to the 120 elementary operations, or ops, on about 10 to the 90 bits. And if you actually look at the exponential progress of Moore's Law and ask when, at what point, could the whole universe become a computer, it's only 250 or 400 years away. So even if we manage to take every elementary particle in the universe and turn it into have it participate in a computation, then Moore's Law couldn't last for more than a few more centuries.
Okay, well, let's be very practical. On your desk is a laptop with a Pentium chip, let's say, and that Pentium chip has a layer of chemicals, the smallest layer being 20 atoms across, 20 atoms across, the smallest layer in a Pentium chip on your desk. In 20 years, in fact, less than 20 years, that layer will be 5 atoms across at the rate at which we're going, 5 atoms across. And at 5 atoms, we have to introduce something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which says you don't really know precisely where that electron is. In which case, if electrons leak out of the layer, your Pentium chip just short-circuited, and your laptop is now useless. And so the question is, how small can you make a transistor before you bump up against atoms, and at the atomic level, everything's uncertain?
Yeah, well, that certainly is something to worry about. And indeed, if Intel starts making chips where the electrons are just leaking out all over the place, the chips wouldn't work. So they clearly can't make them by exactly the same design. However, there's certainly nothing wrong with or nothing against the laws of physics to actually store bits of information at the atomic scale. Indeed, one atom, one bit. As the components of computers get smaller, indeed, quantum effects like the Heisenberg uncertainty kick in. But maybe we can actually take advantage of these effects like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Maybe we can turn it from being a bug into a feature. And indeed, that's what my colleagues and I do when we try to build computers whose feature scale, the size of the bits, are down at the level of individual atoms.
Okay, now let's talk again very practical things when people say, what's in it for me? Well, the government, of course, would ask the same question, what's in it for us? And let's now talk about the CIA. The CIA, of course, is very much interested in breaking codes. They love to break the codes of other nations. But many times to break a code, you have to have a key. And sometimes this key is the ability to factorize a huge number. Let's say I have a number with 100 digits. Take a sheet of paper and write a random set of integers 100 digits long, would fill up many, many sheets of paper. And then you're asked to factorize it as the product of two numbers. Well, how would you do that? It would exhaust most computers, and some people therefore think that certain codes are safe, that it's beyond the ability of most ordinary computers to crack the factorization of a number that's 100 digits long. But now let's talk about computing on atoms. Is it possible that this new generation of computers, this quantum computers that you are pioneering, could be able to crack codes that even the CIA cannot crack?
Well, it's possible. And indeed, if we could build a quantum computer, a computer that stored bits of information on individual atoms, one with only a few tens of thousands of quantum bits and one able to perform a few hundred million operations, which is to say something quite piddling compared with the laptop on my lap right now. If we could build a very small quantum computer, then we could use these kind of weird features like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to compute in a different way. And indeed, in 1994, Peter Shor, then at AT&T, now at MIT, showed that, in fact, you could exploit quantum weirdness to factor large numbers and break these codes with even a rather small quantum computer.
Okay, now let's talk about computers themselves. Everyone talks about the digital age. Everything is digital. But what does digital mean? And what is this zeros and ones that sometimes we see in the press? And like if you saw the movie The Matrix, you saw a bunch of zeros and ones. What are these zeros and ones? And what is the so-called digital age?
So a zero or one is what's called a bit. A bit is the smallest possible chunk of information. And it doesn't have to be zero and one. The famous bits are yes or no, heads or tails, true or false, black or white. Essentially, any thing that can take on two different states, two different distinguishable states, registers a bit. And that's the smallest chunk of information. And the way that digital computers work is they break up information into bits, into its smallest chunks, and then process it that way.
Okay, so if modern society, the wealth of nations, everything we see around us, if it's governed by zeros and ones, then let's now talk about qubits, quantum bits, where atoms don't have to be in zeros and ones states. They could be zeros and ones and in between. So tell us about how atoms can be in between zero and one.
Yeah, so as soon as one starts talking about quantum mechanics, then things start to get weird. Niels Bohr famously said that anyone who can contemplate quantum mechanics without getting dizzy hasn't properly understood it. But let's go on anyway. Back essentially a little more than 100 years ago, physicists including Max Planck, Einstein, Niels Bohr, and others realized that there was an essential chunkiness to nature, a kind of a digital quality, that things that people thought of as being wave-like, like, for instance, light or sound, came in little chunks. Light came in little chunks called photons, a little particle of light. Sound came in little chunks called phonons, a little particle of sound. And so at this quantum level, things that look continuous actually are somewhat digital. For instance, you could have no photons in a spot or one photon in a spot. Or you could have one electron over here or one electron over there. And indeed, that's how a conventional computer registers bits, though with a lot more electrons. So, bucket empty, lots of electrons out of the bucket, that's zero. Bucket full, lots of electrons in the bucket, that's one. Now, in quantum mechanics, says that at bottom the world has this digital feature, which is good because that means we can use this digital nature of the world, this quantum nature, to store digital information. But there's another weird feature of quantum mechanics that goes under the name wave-particle duality. So just as waves like light are made up of particles, so things like particles, like electrons, for instance, have waves associated with them. The wave is an electron's wave tells you something about where the electron is. Now, so in a digital world, an ordinary bit, you could either have an electron here, that's zero, or there. That's one. But in the quantum world, the electron's wave can be both here and there at the same time. So a quantum bit, electron here and there at the same time, is a bit that can register in some funky quantum sense that nobody really understands, zero and one at the same time. Qubits are not either zero or one. They can be zero and one.
Okay, so let's take an analogy of a top, a spinning top. Everyone's played with them as children, and atoms spin, and therefore atoms are also like spinning tops, and atoms can spin either up or down when they're placed in a magnetic field, or at least until the quantum theory came in. And so now we can have tops that spin up, tops that spin down, and tops that spin in between. Now, these qubits, these quantum bits, can be between 0 and 1, and they consist of atoms now, not molecules of silicon that you see on a transistor. So how would you actually now build a quantum computer? Let's say that you were an inventor, have access to laser beams and magnetic fields and the ability to play with atoms, individual atoms. How would you build a quantum computer?
So I guess, in fact, a little more than 10 years ago, I was in that position because quantum computers, the idea you could compute at the level of atoms using quantum mechanics, had been proposed by Paul Benioff and Richard Feynman back in the 1980s. But until by the early 1990s, nobody knew how to build one. Nobody had a clue. And around 1992, 1993, I realized that with off-the-shelf elements like lasers and microwave generators, you could take atoms and make them compute. And the way the type of computing I suggested was, in fact, just what you suggested. We'll take spin as our bit. So spinning up, or we can call that clockwise, is a zero, and spinning down is a one. And then spinning sideways is this funky state of a qubit, zero and one at the same time. So now, if you take such an atom, the spin of the nucleus of an atom, you put the atom in a magnetic field, and then you zap it with microwaves, you can make that bit flip. This is called magnetic resonance. It's the same technique that you use to image your knee when you blow it out while skiing. So if you put on light or microwaves at just the right frequency, it will tickle the nucleus and cause the nucleus to flip. First, it will start at, let's say, it starts at the state zero, or spin up, and then it gradually rotates down through the state spin sideways, zero and one at the same time, to the state spin down, or one. Now, if you have lots of atoms, lots of nuclei, you can address them with different frequencies. You can think, in fact, of these different atoms as essentially listening to different radio stations. So, you know, if I have one atom that listens to 89.7 megahertz, WGBH here in Boston, then a second one, say the first one is carbon, say the second one is hydrogen, will listen to WCRB, 102.5. And when I address these two atoms with microwaves of different frequencies, or radio waves of different frequencies, then if I shine light at 89.7, the carbon atom, which listens to 89.7, will flip. And if I shine light or microwaves at 102.5, then the hydrogen atom, which listens to WCRB, will flip. So I can address atoms individually. And then if you're sensitive to the interaction between the atoms, you can massage those interactions to make up logical operations, for instance, causing the hydrogen atom to flip if and only if the carbon atom is spin down or one. And since at bottom, a computation is nothing more than making bits flip and making one bit flip if another bit or another or several other bits, say, read one, then any computation can be broken down into these simple operations, making bits flip, making them interact with each other. And the atoms in our molecule, the carbon and the hydrogen, can perform a simple computation simply by addressing them with light.
Okay, so let's back up a bit. You have a bunch of atoms, let's say in a line, and you place it in a magnetic field, so the spins are either up or down, or perhaps sideways, a mixture of up and down. And once you have these atoms aligned, then you hit it with microwaves, And at certain frequencies, the atom will absorb the radiation and flip.
That's right.
And each flipping process represents a calculation. Now, because the atom is neither up nor down, but it's a mixture of up and down, you have much more flexibility than in zeros and ones. Okay? Now, then the question is, what kind of computation can you perform on this? Can you do the calculations of a laptop? Can you do 1 plus 1 is 2? What's the world's record for computing on these atoms?
So you can certainly take these atoms and make them do anything that an ordinary digital computer could do. So at the moment, because atoms are very small, and even if you extrapolate Moore's law into the future, depending on how you calculate size, then it will take 25 to 40 years for us to get computers where the components are atomic, even if Moore's law continues at its current breakneck pace. But the quantum computers we've built can do anything that a quantum computer, that an ordinary computer, say with 7 to 10 bits, can do, because that's the size of the computers we're looking at right now. However, so as viewed as classical computers, just doing ordinary operations like 1 plus 1 equals 2, then they're pretty weak, these quantum computers. Not only are they small in actual size, you know, the size of a few of a small molecule, but they're small in terms of power. However, if we start to take advantage of the ability of atoms to read 0 and 1 at the same time, then quantum computers can do things that classical computers can't. And the secret comes from looking what bits can do in a computer. So bits can store data, but they also can be instructions. So 0 can mean do this, right? And 1 is an instruction meaning do that. Now, if I take a quantum bit, a qubit, that reads 0 and 1 at the same time, and I feed it into a quantum computer as an instruction, then the quantum computer will do this, and it will do that at the same time. So quantum computers can multitask or do parallel computation in a way that classical computers can't.
Well, unfortunately, that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Professor Seth Lloyd of MIT, speaking about quantum computers. And as you can tell, we have a long ways to go before quantum computers belong on your desktop. However, the CIA, national governments, yes, they are all desperately working on quantum computers. And if you want to know more about my work, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And we have about 4 million fans on Facebook, and I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers. So go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Good day.